The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League. Things you never thought you might say again. Brighton win at home. Aspilicueta and Alonso score for Chelsea. Newcastle play positive attacking football. Things you knew you would say again. Leeds are fun. Spurs aren't. Liverpool score beautiful goals. And just where does the arm end and the shoulder begin? Jonathan Wilson reacts to a vicious takedown from one of his heroes. We all get to say Jiz Hornkamp if we want. And of course, it's deadline day. Apparently, the excitement is building even if nothing happens. We won't be crossing relentlessly to cold reporters outside training grounds. Also today, Troy Townsend joins us to discuss the sadly predictable racist abuse players continue to receive on social media. We'll answer your questions too. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, welcome back, Barry Glendenning.
Thank you for having me back, Max Rushton.
I didn't have a choice, but I suppose it's nice to see you.
You sent me a WhatsApp message last week saying, and you put it in bold, that you were genuinely happy that I was coming back.
Hang on a second. I think I had the word almost, didn't it?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay. It was worth checking.
You must have had a few drinks, had you?
I can't remember.
You also said that I was your best mate.
No, I didn't do that, did I?
No, you didn't.
No, I didn't. No, because you're not. Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning. This is genuinely true. There's a leading British novelist WhatsApped me last week saying, if I don't hear Barry every 3 days, I really worry about him. Would you mind checking if he's okay?
Which novelist was that?
That's Alex Preston.
Okay.
I think a couple of times in the 2 weeks, I did text Barry to just check he was alive and then I could get on with my day. Marcus Bean, hello.
Hi, guys. You all right?
Yeah, very good. Thanks very much. Look, no real standout games from this weekend. Plenty of talking points, though. We'll start with the most recent, because we can probably all remember that one, which was at the Amex. Brighton 1, Spurs 0. Richard Jolly, first stat of the pod. Brighton's last three Premier League home wins have come in 2019, 2020 and 2021. So, you know, they've got a good year ahead of them, haven't they? Jose said the first half was sad. You're telling me, mate. Graham Potter said their best performance for 2 years. And Wilson, I mean, they were better in every department, weren't they? They played really well.
Yeah, they did. I mean, it's arguably Brighton's best performance since they last beat Tottenham at home back in, what was that, October 2019? When they was that 3-0 or 3-1, which is right near the end of right near the end of the Pochettino era, Brighton have really confused me this season, because every time I watch them, they look good but just don't score goals. And I looked up on the XG charts yesterday to see where West Ham were on XG. Expecting
what a fun life you lead.
Well, I just sort of felt that fifth slightly kind of was flattering West Ham, and given I was writing on that game, I very professionally decided to look that up. and West Ham were ninth, but I think Brighton were seventh, which really shocked me. So this sort of sense that I think a lot of people have had, that they're actually playing a lot better than their position in the table would suggest, is backed up by XG. And for once, they did actually get the goal. And I now think at the bottom of the table, it's a really sort of interesting situation, because Sheffield United are having, it's probably too late for them, but it's not totally impossible they can get out of it. Burnley had those two wins. Fulham, although they haven't won in nine now, are actually playing pretty good football. Newcastle have now rallied a bit. And there's no real sort of, and, you know, if Brighton are now scoring goals and playing as well as they did on Sunday and actually getting the rewards for playing that well, there's no team, I think, who's definitely gone.
Really? Because I'm looking at that, Marcus, and thinking the three who are down there are gone, mainly because of Brighton's win yesterday, Brighton and Newcastle's victories this weekend.
Yeah, I agree. I think Brighton and Newcastle have got enough to stay up. So I'm actually thinking for 100% Sheffield United are down, and the other two are really going to struggle to catch those two. But going back onto Brighton, I think, and Spurs, if you watch Brighton play this season, the processes have always been there. The movement of the ball, the rotations, the passing. And if you look at Spurs, it's the complete opposite. You know, you can't really see a pattern of play or a plan when they're on that pitch. except for against the bigger teams, when they're able to play the counter-attacking football, when they've asked to go against the likes of Brighton, etc., dominate the ball and create chances, they really struggle.
How, Marcus, is that possible? How is it that I don't want to get onto Spurs so quickly because I think Brighton deserves some credit, but comparing the two, you know, the Brighton midfield move the ball progressively. They look like they know where they're going. How can... Is that just Graham Potter knows how to do that and Jose doesn't? What is it?
I think Brighton are a better coach team. I think it's as simple as that. I think you look at the likes of Brighton, you look at the likes of Dean Smith at Villa, Hasenhüttl at Southampton. Those players look like they're very well coached. And it's almost, I suppose, crazy saying that because you're talking about a manager in Mourinho who's won so many trophies, etc. But coaching is an art. And it seems like someone like Graham Potter and the people I mentioned before have got that down to a T, whereas Mourinho looks like he's got a bunch of very good players and they look like they've just been put out there and said, play. And I think that's the difference.
Barry, Spurs are a hard watch, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, if I could just talk about Brighton briefly, I possibly incur what passes for the wrath of Brighton fans. They seem a fairly amiable bunch, but I didn't actually think they played that well. I didn't think they played particularly better than they usually do. And I think they could conceivably have only got a point out of that game and it would have been an absolute embarrassment because Spurs were so diabolically awful. We know Brighton are good at moving the ball forward. They're bad at defending, but yesterday they had little or nothing to defend against. And their problem has always been scoring goals. Yesterday, they only scored one when they probably should have scored four or five. So it was a brilliant win for them. And you can only beat what's in front of you. But what was in front of them last night was just inexplicably bad. Spurs defended abysmally without Harry Kane. They had little or nothing to offer up front. I think they had two shots. Bergwijn pulled one wide of the upright and Carlos Vinicius had a good shot saved by Sanchez in the Brighton goal. But I would say, yeah, Spurs were a hard watch. They were terrible. They don't seem to have anything resembling a plan going forward if they're missing a key player in the form of Harry Kane. And Brighton, I think, should have won by more.
Jonathan, Barry says it's inexplicable. Can you try and explain why Tottenham is so bad? It's just, you see other teams lose and you think, okay, well, that, you know, they lost, but I can take this positive and that positive. But it's just, you know, they're so flat when they lose. They're pretty flat when they win, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it comes back to what we were saying sort of back last year, back before they had that little run of results around November time, that Mourinho's conception of football it feels as if football has moved on and it's this very predictable style based on counter-attacking. And when you have two players as good as Son and Kane playing as well together as they were, then it can get results. And you know, when we were talking about them as potential title challenges, I think it was why you're accepting this is not a normal season. The planning and the sophisticated pressing that we've seen come to dominate football over the last 3 to 4 years, and perhaps before that, but particularly the last 3 to 4 years, where you're seeing, you know, to go back to all those coaches Marcus mentioned before, that Hasenhüttl and Potter, even sort of your mid-ranking Premier League sides are playing quite sophisticated football compared to 5 or 10 years ago. And Mourinho does seem to have been slightly left behind by that. But it did seem that this season, because there's so little time to prepare for each game, that maybe football had gone backwards a bit and an older style of football could prevail. But I mean, the stats were suggesting that the only team in Premier League history since from 92 that was so reliant on two players for goals and assists was Sunderland in 1999-2000 with Quinn and Phillips. Now, you're not comparing like with like there. For Sunderland to have Quinn and Phillips was an amazing thing because they elevated a very ordinary side. Tottenham should be much, much better than that. They shouldn't be reliant on two players. And the problem when you are reliant on two players is if one of them gets injured, you've got big trouble. And Tottenham, I think we've seen the problems mounting really since they lost at Anfield. And when Kane's gone, those problems are really obvious.
Marcus, you're on the way to becoming a director of football, a big man in a boardroom. Are you going to, if you were Daniel Levy, slightly different role, what would you do?
Firstly, I wouldn't have probably appointed Mourinho for starters. So I think he made a mistake there. And I was saying that to all my Tottenham friends as well, mates as well. They were excited. And I said, listen, you've got to be careful what you wish for. I think I'd wait to the end of the season and I'd pull the trigger. I think Tottenham need to start thinking long term. Mourinho was a very short term plan. I think if you look at the teams at the top of the league, Man City, Liverpool, they're thinking in 3 to 5 years stages, where Spurs are thinking about 1 year, trying to win a trophy, just appease the fans. And I think that's what Levy's done, and it's backfired.
Mourinho is very much his vanity project, that appointment, and to get rid of him so quickly would make him look quite foolish. And I suspect he's quite a vain man who has no interest in making himself look foolish.
I think so. I completely agree. I think it would make him look silly, but I think as when you're in a leadership position, you know, you've got to take those tough decisions, and it's one that he needs to, you know, look past himself and think about the greater good of the club and get it done, in my opinion.
Barry, you could start a kind of consultancy for big egoed chairman of how to look foolish. How to look foolish and get out of bed the next day. I think you'd be really good at that. Before we move on to Liverpool's win, Jonathan, Gareth Bale is an interesting case study. And, you know, I don't know how much is his, you know, there seems to be a lot of, well, it hasn't really worked, has it? That may be his fault, or not his neat leg's fault, or it may be Jose's fault. I don't know whose fault it is.
Yeah, and the one thing I would say is for various reasons, he has not had a run of games, and it may be that he needs a run of games. So in Kane's absence, he presumably will get a run of games. So it could be that in 5 or 6 games' time, he does look a lot better. But yeah, he's nothing like the player he was even 2 years ago at the moment.
Yeah, it almost looks like he doesn't like trust his body, you know. And there were signs in that cup game, who was it, against Wickham, when you thought, actually, I mean, you know, those Wickham defenders must still be quite, you know, I know not everyone who's played for Wickham, Marcus, has been a great athlete, but some of them must be able to run. And I thought maybe that was a slight turning point. But anyway, yeah, that defeat comes off the back of that game against Liverpool, which obviously happened after the pod on Thursday, where they gifted Liverpool those goals. But Liverpool really turned it on, and they went to West Ham yesterday and beat West Ham pretty convincingly. Elliot says, how much would you have to pay to take that Salah first touch out for dinner? Liverpool's second goal, Barry, was absolutely... It was almost worth watching all the hours of football that are now on to just see that goal. It was just the moment of the weekend for me.
It's one of those rare goals, you see, that gets you on your feet, off the sofa and on your feet, just marvelling at it. There was two such efforts over the weekend, but one was a Judd Trump pot of a green ball and a snooker table, and
really
the other was which just seemed to defy the laws of physics. I'm still trying to figure out how he did it. And Mo Salah's touch was, I would have that in second place, I think, behind Judd. But a wonderful goal from a West Ham corner. Trent Alexander-Arnold, I think it was, played the crossfield ball to Shaqiri. His cross was remarkable. And the Salah touch and roll past Fabianski was absolutely the goal of the weekend, and definitely a contender for goal of the season. I'm not sure he'll get goal of the season, but it's certainly up there.
Jonathan, Liverpool, they're back on it, would you say, after that slightly little that little drab run they had?
Last two games, there have been passages of each of them where they've played really, really well. I don't really understand what went wrong in that run. If you look at the shot counts in all those games, they dominated all of them. Even the game against Manchester United, they had significantly more shots. So I don't really know why they suddenly stopped scoring for 5 games. But yeah, they second half, they looked really good. And I think the really encouraging thing for them is how well Jordan Henderson's now playing at centre-back. that I thought he was excellent yesterday. The first cross into the box, I think it was the 9th minute, and he just got in front of Suchek, who was sort of moving at pace onto the, there's a ball in from the left, and you sort of, I think it was Mikel Antonio had got in behind Alexander Arnold, and there's a good ball in. You sort of, as it went across, you sort of thought, this should be a goal. And Henderson just nipped in, and from there I know they did concede from a corner, very late on, but I thought he really looked good in that role, and I thought it was telling as well that the player who celebrated first for Salah for that second goal was Henderson, that even at that stage of the game, 68 minutes or whatever, he managed to have the energy to run 70 yards, so that had Salah miscontrolled it, he'd have picked up the loose ball, so. His willingness to take on new positions and do things that maybe don't come naturally to him, I think is one of the reasons Liverpool have been so good over the last 2 or 3 years.
Let's go to Goodison. Everton 0, Newcastle 2. At last, Barry, we can say something new about Newcastle United. We can't just cut and paste from the last, I don't know how many years, podcasts. It ends a run of 11 consecutive games in all competitions without a win since beating West Brom in December. Is this Bruce Ball?
Apparently not. It was an excellent performance by Newcastle, who were unrecognisable from the rabble we're kind of used to seeing, and a good result away at Everton, who continue to display all the hallmarks of being Everton, despite threatening to get rid of that earlier in the season. But I noticed that Newcastle Twitter are giving all the credit for this victory to their new to Graham Jones, who's come in as a new member of their coaching staff from Bournemouth. He's previously worked with Roberto Martinez at Wigan, Everton in Belgium, and he had a brief stint at Luton as manager last year, but was sacked. But it was a really good win for Newcastle, for which Steve Bruce, predictably enough, is getting no credit whatsoever.
Marcus, could a new coach come in and in a matter of 3 days change?
He participated in 1 2-hour training session.
He's a genius. He's amazing. What difference can a new coach have in a short space of time?
Well, listen, I do think they can have a big difference. We know we're going to talk about Chelsea later, but if you look at Tuchel when he came in, and then I think he came on the Tuesday, and then by the Wednesday he had the game, and they looked like a completely different side. And so it's possible. I don't know how much of the session he took. That's probably the big question, because obviously Bruce is the manager. There is possible that he can have a big influence in such a sports space of time.
But could he come in and say, basically, be the manager, come in and say, we should need to play a diamond, you need to, put someone up with Callum Wilson. I think Fraser played up front there, do all that. And Steve just goes, I'm so bereft of ideas, I'll take anything, do whatever you like.
But I think that's part of management. I think if you've got somebody there that is tactically very good and astute, and you're more of a man manager, just let him get on with it. I think Alex Ferguson used to do that quite a bit. He used to just observe, and he used to let his assistants do the job. And I think that is part of being a good manager, just knowing your role almost.
Jake says, who scored the best header? Callum Wilson v Everton, or Barry, the one that he talked about for about 25 minutes on the Christmas pod, which we think was an own goal because it went in off the post and hit the keeper. He played brilliantly, Wilson, didn't he? Wilson.
Yeah, he did. I mean, could easily have had 4 goals. But I think, nobody's ever doubted his ability. The problem is he is susceptible to injury. When he joined Newcastle, you sort of thought, well, that's a much better signing than what they had up front last season, when Joe Linton was being played in a position that he didn't seem at all comfortable with. But we've seen this season that you can't rely on him to play 30 of the 38 games. You might get half the games out of him, but in those half, he will be very good.
Did anybody see Yerry Mina giving Callum Wilson what at my school was called a nipple cripple? CD says, known as a purple Herbie at my school for some reason, twisting the nipple and pulling it at the same time.
But he's a tremendous shithouse, Yerry Mina.
Yeah. But that is really, Marcus, I don't know if you've ever partaken or if you have ever been on the end of a purple Herbie on the pitch?
No, I've never been on one of those, thankfully.
That's really, I mean, I thought that was a step too far.
My nipples are quite small, so I don't know if he'd be able to grab it. Yeah, grab it.
Who knows how big Callum Wilson's nipples are?
True.
No, they're bigger now.
They are, aren't they? Anyway, it looked really sore. I thought it was outrageous. And then I've just written Barry, oh, Everton. Neil, bringing up an old pod favourite, have you inadvertently put a curse on the Toffees by inventing the Everton Cup? Are they destined to never finish above seventh? Witchcraft. Just about when we would have to say you have to start taking them seriously and they turn in this drivel.
Yeah, I mean, Carlo Ancelotti is generally pretty calm and takes most things in his stride, but you could see after this game he was very unhappy with his players and he had every right to be, but I think for once, you know, we should probably give Newcastle the credit they deserve and not riff on Everton's Evertonness.
Okay, fair enough. Very quickly before the end of part one, Manchester City 1, Sheffield United 0. Insert Jonathan Wilson, a boring cliche about winning ugly games like this is what wins you titles. They've won their last 12 games in all competitions, the longest winning run in their history. I just presumed at some point in the last 5 years they've won like 100 games in a row. But it wasn't straightforward this win. And Sheffield United did play well and had, you know, that John Fleck chance went wide just at the end. But sort of City look ominously good at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've sort of bought themselves the right to have a slightly iffy win, given how well they've played in those previous 11 games. That, yeah, they I think by some margin the most consistently excellent side over the last sort of month and a half. I mean, the calendar's so compressed, it seems ridiculous. I think it was December 15th when they drew against West Brom, and you sort of were thinking, it's all going to be wrong. This is Pep in his fifth season, and since then, yeah, they've let in 2 goals, I think, in total, 1 in the league. And that one in the league was the late goal of Chelsea when they were already 3-0 up. And you wonder as well whether the strange environment has actually helped them in the longer term, that Pep has had to sort of reassess how you play. He can't play the quite such a high press as he might have liked to have played. And they do have a slightly more balanced approach. And I guess next Sunday against Liverpool and then in the Champions League games, we'll see how solid that improvement is. But at the minute, they appear to have worked out a way of playing with a very solid base and still to have the fluency that defines them at their best.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Leeds' excellent performance at the King Power. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Leicester 1, Leeds 3. Stephen says, is Jonathan Wilson relieved that Leeds beat Leicester so he doesn't have to spend at least 10 minutes of the pod defending Bielsa by explaining his influence on the modern game? Jonathan, I thought Leeds were brilliant in this game. It was a really good game of football, actually, and they were superb. And Patrick Bamford had a brilliant game, didn't he?
It was by some way, I think, the best Premier League game of the weekend, just as a spectacle to watch. The 3 goals that Leeds scored, each of them was a brilliant goal. But yes, I am relieved that I don't have to get involved in this ludicrous tribal thing. Yeah, I think Bielsa does many good things. He does some things I don't like as much. But here it worked, and it might not have worked. You know, Leicester had their chances, and it was just a really good game of football. As I think the reverse fixture was when Leicester won 4-1. Yeah, that equally was a really good game of football.
Bamford's been directly involved in 15 goals in his 20 Premier League games for Leeds, 11 goals, 4 assists. Only Tony Yeboah has had a hand in more goals in their first 20 Premier League games for the club. And all of Tony Yeboah's were just whacked into the net. I mean, I may have made that bit up. His finish was superb, Marcus. His assist was like perfectly played. Gareth Southgate was there. How far down the pecking order for England is he, and how far up the pecking order should he be?
He should be near the top. I think in terms of a pure footballer, he's got everything. Having played against him, I was always marvelled at his, from such a young age as well, his movement, his ability to find space, his touch was amazing, his vision was good. And I've never, even when Leeds were, last season when he was missing quite a lot of chances, I always knew that Bielsa would really struggle to replace him. I think they probably looked, but trying to find a player with his skill set is very difficult. I think that he's definitely should be really up the at the pecking order for England, especially because he's got a lot of the same attributes as Kane. If you look at him, his ability to drop into space and hold the ball up and find passes is very similar to Harry
Kane. Did you ever get close enough to tweak the nipples of Patrick Bamford?
He's a very difficult player to get close to, as you've seen in the Premier League this season. So no nipple tweaking.
I suppose who's above him? Calvert-Lewin, Ings, maybe Callum Wilson in terms of strikers that Southgate has picked, Jonathan?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the question there with Calvert-Lewin is obviously a very different type of forward. That, you know, he's much more of a target man type. So I mean, I guess England will take four in the squad. So having a slightly different option is a good thing. You know, if England do want to go long late on, and you know, we've seen Southgate in a couple of recent games doing that. Callum Wilson, I guess the question is always, what state of fitness will he be in? If he is in form come May, June, then yes. But he's also, what age is he now, Callum Wilson? Is he 30 yet?
Something like that.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's, which is not a problem, but I guess in 2 or 3 years that might become a start to count against him. Ings as well has had a lot of injuries recently, so you don't quite know what shape he'll be in by then. But yeah, I think our point about Bamford being as similar to Kane as any English striker in the Premier League at the moment, I think that could be the key one. That it's not quite like for like, but it's probably as near as you're going to get.
Callum was on 28, 29 in February. Many, many apologies, Callum, for ageing you by between a year and 2 years. I hope you forgive us. Rafinha's pass to Bamford was really nice as well, Jonathan. And he did it a couple of times in the game, didn't he? He's a really lovely player.
Yeah, I mean, I think Leeds have been bought very well in the summer. That Rafinha and Rodrigo both have fitted in very well. I mean, I think it was telling that Leeds finished with the 11 on the pitch had all played in the Championship for them last season. And I think that can be the problem for teams that have such a defined style as Leeds do. And I think we saw that with, say, Guardiola's Barcelona. It's quite difficult for outsiders to come in and integrate. But the two of them do seem to have done that very well. And I think, I mean, you need to see more, I guess. But I think Robin Koch had done that as well before he got injured. That one of the reasons, I think, for Leeds' little wobble before the last two games was the number of injuries they had at centre-back and the absence of Koch.
Damari Gray signed for Leverkusen, just if you wanted some transfer. And breaking news, I understand I'm hearing that Damari Gray's gone to Leverkusen. Some less offence.
I just thought you were moving swiftly along before someone made an absence of cock joke.
Well, I was hoping that no one would bring it up. There was I left a pregnant pause for the listeners. I thought, you know, we've got four goals from Jiz Hornkamp later, Barry. We don't need to blow our load quite yet, do we? Some Leicester fans got annoyed when we said they missed Vardy in the last game, but they missed Vardy in this game. Although Harvey Barnes took his goal really well, didn't he?
I thought Leicester played quite well in that game, actually. So against Leeds, I mean, so it was sort of a statement win for Leeds because it's the first big team they've actually beaten. They've come close a few times, but Leicester didn't play badly and Leeds still won quite comfortably. So it was good for them.
To the Emirates, Arsenal 0, Manchester United 0. Producer Joel said, quite an entertaining 0-0. Lots of chances missed. Marcus, I wasn't sure this was an entertaining 0-0. How entertained were you?
I'm agreeing with you. I wasn't that entertained. I think it was a good tactical battle. So from that sense, it was entertaining. But as a spectacle, then no, it wasn't that that great, to be honest.
Manchester United now unbeaten in 18 Premier League away games. The longest run without defeat on the road in their top flight history. A lot of talk afterwards, Jonathan, was sort of criticism of Manchester United for not really going for it. They've had 0-0s against the so-called bigger teams before at Anfield, at home to City, at home to Chelsea. Do you want to be critical of them or not?
I wouldn't necessarily criticise them specifically for this game. And they had a couple of decent chances, particularly in the second half. I guess you could say Arsenal at the bar in the second half as well. But I think there is a wider issue there that if you look at their results against the big six this season, and they've played them all once, but Arsenal twice. And I think they've only scored one goal. And that was getting beat 6-1 by Tottenham, which I would suggest is non-ideal. And I think this comes back to a problem that that you know we've highlighted about Solskjaer quite a lot, that they got results last season by playing on the break. And they, you know, if you give them a chance to play on the break against you, they can hurt you. And, you know, they beat City 3 times last season. They beat Liverpool in the cup doing that. But if the opposition sort of doesn't give you the chance to do that, if the opposition says, you know what, we're happy with a clean sheet, you know, we'll both stand here and watch each other, United really don't have a lot else. That they have individuals who can do something brilliant, and the squad is now good enough. They've probably got 4 of them. So, you know, they've got Bruno Fernandes, they've got Pogba, they've got Rashford, they've got Cavani, all of whom can do something that'll turn a game, you know, in one moment of brilliance. But I don't think they have a particularly cohesive or coordinated attacking plan.
Martin Ødegaard, the first Norwegian to appear for Arsenal since Pal Lydersen against Tottenham in May 1993. We didn't see a lot of him in this game, but Joachim writes, Ødegaard was voted man of the match by the viewers of Norwegian TV2. In fact, he'd received 41% of the vote before he was subbed on. Have we ever seen it?
Well, I mean, David Luiz got man of the match on, was it Sky or BT? Purely for celebrating after heading away a free kick. So it didn't take much winning. No. I mean, this game was quite odd insofar as a lot of people seem to have thought it was very entertaining, 0-0. I'm with you, Marcus. I was bored to tears by this game.
I thought the second half was decent, actually. The first half was poor. I quite enjoyed the second half.
Wilson, more importantly, on the philosophy or lack of it for Manchester United, you got some stinging criticism from the actor who plays DS Aidan Healy in Vera. You're a big fan of Vera, so this really must have cut to the bone. Kenny Doughty writes, it's a non-article, don't bite, lots of words but no content. He got a paycheck to write his idea, in inverted commas, idea of success in football, ignore. Football is beyond sports journalism. Jonathan.
Well, all I can presume is that he's preparing for a role as a very tribal Manchester United fan, and he's deep in character, and I salute that. I mean, I'm not just saying this because he said that, but the honest truth is that he's not as good as David Leon, who preceded him. I thought Joe Ash was the better character than Aidan Healy. But, you know, this is not a situation like Lewis where I struggle to watch it now because of Lawrence Fox. I will continue to enjoy Vera. And I think Kenny Doughty's very much entitled to his opinion. And I would love a chance to discuss this with him more, perhaps on the set of Vera at some point in the future.
Someone from Vera would really understand what a philosophy is, because if any show has a philosophy, it's Vera. It's very much, you know what the DNA, you know what the Vera way is, don't you? And, you know, Kenny Doughty was a like for like. It wasn't like Sir Alex replacing, you know, Mike Phelan with Rene Meulensteen. You know, they're very similar characters. They all look, it's quite hard. You get them muddled up. You know, Joe and Aidan. Well, so he really understands the philosophy of something. So I'm minded to follow his view over your view when it comes to the philosophy of Manchester United.
Well, you'd be wrong. But, I mean, all I'd say is 2 league games since then, 1 point. And also, because he understands that philosophy so well, I think it'd be very useful for us to eat fish and chips together, looking out moodily over the North Sea. And I think we could resolve our differences in that way.
Can you just, for those who didn't read the article, what were you basically saying?
Oh, well, what I was saying was that perhaps one of the reasons why, I mean, United were top of the table when I said this, one of the reasons why they'd perhaps done better this season than we'd expected was that by being more based on individuals, you know, exactly what we've just been talking about, rather than having this sort of very defined tactical philosophy in the way that, say, Liverpool do, perhaps that has made it easier for them to adjust in a very unusual season when you don't have the time to prepare for individual games. And I was making the point that Manchester United as a club over time have been a club very focused on individuals. And I was looking at the team of the 60s, who won 2 league titles and the European Cup. But if you go back and you look at stuff that, for instance, Noel Cantwell said when he went there from West Ham in 60 or 61, he went there. Stuff that Morris Setters was saying. They were also, Eamon Dunphy. So Eamon Dunphy's brilliant book on Busby, Strange Kind of Glory, talks about this. The fact that a lot of players who come from elsewhere got to Manchester United. We go, well, hang on, is this it? Why are we not training? Why are we not sort of practicing? How to find other players in our team? And your Cantwell, there's a quote from him saying, "Give it to a red shirt. That's all very well, but how do I know where they are if we haven't prepared for it?" John Giles, when he left and went to Leeds, said it was like a breath of fresh air going into Leeds' training, and suddenly there was a structure to it. And so there was a lot of doubts in the early 60s as to whether United had sort of moved on as the game had moved on. Because this was a time when you had Harry Potts at Burnley, Revy at Leeds, Shankly at Liverpool, Bill Nicholson at Tottenham, who were putting together a more structured type of football. Alf Ramsey at Ipswich and then with England. And Busby's football was not like that. And so there's a line when they win the league in 67, for I can't remember which player it was, saying we were like the last man to win Wimbledon with a wooden racket. Yeah, there was a recognition this was an old style of football, but because they had three of the greatest players ever to play the game in Charlton, Best and Law, they got away with it. And I think that sort of those values have sort of been there at United throughout. And one of the reasons it fell away so quickly when Busby retired in 69 was that they didn't have a philosophy to fall back on. And so when those big three started to get injuries or got older or, best case, were overwhelmed by their demons, there was nothing left.
I don't know. What does Kenny think?
Vera? Well, he's just shrugging. It's just words. Just words.
You better have a look at this, Mom. That's what he said. Chelsea 2, Burnley 0. Graham says, now that Tuchel is confirmed as the best manager in the league and Marcos Alonso is in line for player of the year, when are we going to stop overreacting to the last thing we saw and realise that recency bias should be devalued a bit? Terrible news, Barry, for the youngsters that Tuchel hates. He hates all young players, with Aspilicueta and Alonso scoring their goals. What did you make of this?
Well, I suppose the game was summed up by the exchange between Sean Dyche and Robbie Brady, where Callum Hudson-Odoi, who played brilliantly and really tormented Burnley, Dyche sort of did the fingers to the temples thing in the direction of Brady, telling him to wake up and keep an eye on young Callum, and Brady sort of went shouted over to him, "I know where he fucking is, I just can't stop him. What do you want me to do?" So that was sort of summed up Burnley's performance in a nutshell. I suppose I didn't realise the solution to Chelsea's problems was to play two geriatric Spanish fullbacks, but there you go, that's why he gets the big bucks and I'm stuck here talking to you.
I mean, Alonso's goal finish was absolutely bad. Aspilicueta's wasn't bad. Alonso's finish was stunning. What have you made of Tuchel so far, Marcus?
I've been very impressed. I think what he's brought into the club is that they're now controlling possession in a way that the other team, he stifles the other team's opportunities to score. I think in the last two games, the two teams have only got, I think it's five or six shots on goal in two games, which is exceptional. I watched large parts of the Burnley game and it looked like they didn't have a sniff, to be honest. I think he's been very good, a breath of fresh air. And I think what he's done is very well is bring back the likes of Marcos Alonso from the dead. It shows that now everyone's got...
I mean, he's not that old, well, Marcus. The zombie of Marcos Alonso.
We've taken him out of the
animated Marcos Alonso.
there's James Tarkowski with a... how do you kill a zombie? Is that a steak? How do you...
I have to stove in its head. And
you have to stove... There he is. He's with a massive spade. Tarkowski, this is the only way we can get Alonso. Okay. Sorry, Marcus.
Yeah, he's taken him out of the wilderness. And I think what that does to the group is show that everyone's got a fresh clean slate and a fresh start, and it does give the group a massive boost.
West Brom 2, Fulham 2. Barry, an entertaining game that doesn't really help either of them.
That's about the size of it, Max. Yeah, I thought Fulham were slightly unlucky. They were a goal up, and at one point Ajayi put his arm across Adam Lookman as he tried to shoot. He brought a save out of Sam Johnston. I think if Lookman had gone down at that challenge, he would have got a penalty. Fulham could have, although given Fulham's record with penalties this season, it's no guarantee they'd have scored it, but they could have been 2-0 up. It's a game that could have gone either way. I've been impressed with Fulham's football from what I've seen of it in recent weeks, but they're just not getting the wins that they need and probably deserve.
Southampton 0, Villa 1. Marcus, some fun VAR in this game. There was the Matty Cash handball that sort of flicked off his thigh, but looked like it should have been a penalty. And then Danny Ings equalises in injury time. And I had a thought, what if they changed the law? So if the attacker's knees are behind the defender's buttocks, then that's okay, because... and John McGinn tweeted, just as well it wasn't my backside as well. I think it was Matty Cash's. Were Southampton unlucky in this game with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think, first of all, I think that's a clear handball. I know maybe the VAR staff are kind of under a lot of pressure now because of the rule change and trying to really understand it. But, you know, that's a clear handball. I think if your arms are that far away from your body, regardless if it comes off your knee, that's a handball, in my opinion. And then the offside, I suppose that one, listen, that's the rules. They've changed it now. It's the shirt sleeve. So I suppose they can be forgiven for that one. But the first one's a clear handball.
Crystal Palace 1, Wolves 0. Elhiv says, is it morally right to sack Nuno because he donated £250,000 the other day, even though the last 7 months of my football watching life have been the worst for over 4 years?
I mean, 4 years. I mean, poor Ben. Right? I mean, there's a very obvious reason why Wolves are having a harder... or two obvious reasons why Wolves are having a harder season, which is they've sold Diogo Jota and they've lost him in a to a horrific injury. So, obviously, when you lose two of your best forwards, it's harder to score goals. I don't think it's particularly Nuno's fault. I think he has a lot of credit in the bank, and to sack him now would be... pretty disappointing for everybody.
His donation matched a £250,000 grant from the Premier League PFA Community Fund to launch Feed Our Pack, which will support selected food banks in Wolverhampton. What I hope is to engage the community so that people can help. It is not just about getting financial support, but getting engaged, getting volunteers. Many people are volunteering themselves on a daily basis to distribute food, the bags and transport. Behind the scenes, they are the true heroes of this moment. I am just one more. It's a canny move. And I'm not being a cynic. What a nice thing to do. I criticise someone for giving £250,000 to charity.
No, hats off to him. But, I mean, they've lost Jota and they've lost Jimenez, but... it's not just toothlessness up front that seems to be the problem. Their whole approach seems much more timid. It's quite weird, really, how into their shell they've gone.
Mm. Well, we'll find out what happens, won't we? That's what we say. We'll see. That's what Charlie Baker says. You can end any football conversation with, we'll see. And he's absolutely right.
I think Wolves have always been quite cautious. Wolves playing badly are terrible to watch because they are quite a cautious side, but... they're now cautious, but without any punch up front. So it not only makes it more obvious that they're cautious, it also probably makes them more cautious because they don't have the goals in them. So I don't think it's a surprising turn of events, that.
All right, that'll do for part two. Troy Townsend from Kick It Out will join us for part three. More black players getting racially abused on social media. It's sort of tragically predictable by now, but we'll chat about that in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's welcome Troy Townsend from Kick It Out. Troy, how are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Not too bad at all.
Look, it's always nice to talk to you, but at the same time, it's
you don't mean
never nice
don't
to talk
mean
to you.
That, Max. You know you don't mean that. I know you don't mean that. So let's just crack on. Look,
all right, okay. Right, so look, Greater Manchester Police have confirmed they're investigating racist comments sent to a number of Manchester United players over social media. United's Marcus Rashford, Axel Tuanzebe, Anthony Martial have all been targeted, along with Romain Soyuz, West Brom, Chelsea's Reece James as well. Oliver Dowden, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, says he'll continue to lead roundtable discussions with current and former players across the men's and women's games to get their perspective on tackling discrimination and abuse in the game. The PFA have called for greater use of technology from social media companies to prevent users from sharing abuse. The thing is, Troy, it's just... the really depressing thing is I'm just so unsurprised that it's happened. It's almost like if a black player didn't get racist abuse after a draw or a defeat. That would be more surprising now.
Yeah, that's where we are now. You know, we're on this merry-go-round of, you know, racial abuse on these platforms, the condemnation, the conversations. And then we just loop and go round and round again, round the circle again, you know. And the Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, obviously owned by Facebook, there comes a time when there has to be an accountability for what is being posted on those platforms and the targeting of professional people or anybody, to be totally honest. Let's be serious. These people are human beings first and foremost, you know, and the impact of the abuse that they're receiving, you know, which cannot be in the stadiums no more because we're not there, is, you know, should be treated as it is, which is racial hate crime. It is hate crime. And if that's the case, there should be knocks on the door for everybody who decides that they're going to target a player just because, you know, they are deemed to make a mistake or have done something wrong in their eyes, you know. And the fact that we're on this revolving merry-go-round as well, the fact that we're at this stage again where the government are involved and the conversations are going on and all the you know, the piling is, you know, it's technology. It's a piece of tech. It's a piece of tech that, you know, those at Twitter and those at Facebook should be able to apply. It doesn't need the round and round and round of conversation. The impact is there. Anyone that doesn't appreciate the impact of being dehumanized, devalued because of the color of their skin, then talk to a few of those players, like they said they have done, and really realize the impact and how far it goes, particularly down to close members, family members, etc. You know, this is not just a one-stop thing where you see a post and you think, okay, there's another one. Let me just put that aside. It has a mental well-being impact as well, and maybe that's not appreciated enough.
I thought it was interesting that Marcus Rashford didn't put up a screen grab. Other players have put up screen grabs of them. And I wonder what you think about what the right thing to do is, because it goes against my instincts to not send it out. But at the same time, you almost wonder if the people sending the abuse want it to be seen. Just sort of, I mean, I'm sort of torn about what the right thing to do is. Clearly report and get these social media companies to and the police to get involved. But I don't know if it's right to give them any oxygen. And I've certainly sort of changing my view on
it's an
that.
Individual choice. It's an individual choice. Certain players will want to do it. Certain players will feel that, you know, there's no point, you know, particularly of the week that we've had. What Marcus would have revealed was no different to what Reece James revealed, was no different to what Axel revealed. So actually, you know, it's within their own, that own individual right to do whatever they want to do. He's been targeted. It's quite clear and apparent what that abuse was. Is if anyone wanted to find it, they could find it. It's very similar. It's the emojis, you know, where it's a gorilla, it's the banana, it's the monkey with a few choice words to go with it. They're all much of a muchness now, but that is an individual's choice whether they want to expose the people that are doing it whilst also reporting, or whether they, you know, what's the point? I might as well just keep this to myself with some very, very strong and important words. And Marcus obviously has been very, very good with his words over this period of time. So yeah, he chose to do it that way.
Is there anything that any of us can do about it? It just seems to me so obvious. It's a social media thing, and it's not like people are going to make a stand and not use these social media platforms. Mm. You know, people are going to carry on. You know, I've tweeted this morning, you know, we use social media for content for this pod. You know, everyone uses it. It's not like people will stop using it. That's the only thing it's the only way they would listen, isn't it? Is everyone just deleted all their social media?
Financially, they would listen if it had a financial impact. You know, if you're going to say that you're going to get a punishment every time someone posts something derogatory, racist, sexist, homophobic on your platforms, and there was a penalization for that because you haven't, you know, protected people on your platforms, they should have a duty of care to protect every single person on their platform, you know, from hate, from discrimination. And the fact that maybe there's nothing in place for them at the moment, you know, the government are working on this harms bill, which will maybe put them under a bit of pressure. What's in that bill, I don't know. When it comes out, I don't know, which means at the moment we're just exposing people to that continued, you know, threat of being abused. There isn't, what can anyone do? It's down to the tech parts of those industries. You know, we work with an organization called Signify, who've given us an absolutely unbelievable insight into the tech industry. So me walking in here would have thought, well, maybe it's just a press of a button and they can eliminate all words, etc. It isn't much farther away from that. And Signify have taught us how, you know, you can home in on an individual. You can understand their history. You can see if they're connected to any kind of groups or anything like that. And you can flag up words and phrases, etc., before they even get to the victim as such.
There's a lot of debate about if everybody had to be verified, if everybody every account had to be verified with, you know, some sort of ID, that would be a way of stopping this. But there are sort of interesting arguments against that in terms of, you know, there are some people that don't have the various forms of ID. It could become quite a kind of, it's sort of slightly socially elitist to say that, because some people who are on these platforms, you know, don't have driving licenses, don't have passports, et cetera, et cetera. But with that Signify thing, you wouldn't need everyone to be verified, because you can see who's sending that anyway. Exactly. Even if they are just a face of an egg and they're called, you know, Bertie17784123, you could just say, right, we found who that person is. We know exactly who they are, where it's coming from. The police could be knocking at their door within the hour.
Exactly. Right? And well, I think you're putting it to the extreme there, within the hour, but definitely they'll be able to identify and understand who that person is and what they've been linked to. You know, we've got to also say that, you know, police forces up and down the country obviously have got probably more important things on their mind at the moment and difficult things that they have to deal with. Is this high priority? I've got to, praise West Midlands Police, who we've been working with on a number of situations, for the swiftness in which they've approached a lot of those situations, particularly Romaine Sawyers recently. But even in that, let's talk about, that verification process. From my understanding, the minimum age you're allowed on those platforms is 13. Does that need to be raised? You know, do we need 13-year-olds on a platform? A 12-year-old, targeted Wilf Sahar back in the summer, and there's apparent rumours of a 12-year-old again being involved in this Romaine Sawyer situation. So how are 12-year-olds being allowed to get on the platform? Because it's very easy to put a different, you know, age into the process, and it means you're in. You know, so does there need to be parental guidance for anyone under 16 or 18, whatever it may be?
Have you got any hope, Troy?
Hope is a massive word in this context. I think we always have to have hope, but let's be serious. I mean, kicking out is 28 years old now, you know, and we're talking about the same things that we were talking about back in 1993, but just on a different platform. There's no fans in stadiums. Anger's being directed towards the social media platforms, which I knew was going to happen. I'm just going to sit here and say I knew it was going to happen. It's the only place for people to vent that anger. We have to still have hope. But it's been a very long time that we've seen our black players discriminated against and actually nothing being done. The rise of Black Lives Matter and the stance that the players have taken, the importance of what the message they're trying to achieve, whilst it is very significant and one of the most important and powerful things I've seen, and I'll judge that, has also sent a wave of opinion that is negative towards what the players are trying to achieve as well. And, you know, when we do finally get fans back in the stadiums, which hopefully, I know we had a little period of, but hopefully it's not too far away, is there still going to be negativity towards the players taking the knee and everything that that represents in terms of the solidarity, but also their stance against, you know, for racial equality? So hope is a massive, massive, question at this stage. I think I wouldn't work in this industry if there wasn't hope. The stages to get to the end of the spelling of hope are massive. And whether we achieve those in the short term or whether it's still a long-term project, you know, we'll be judged on that as we go along.
Troy, thanks for coming on, mate. Appreciate it.
Thank you. No worries at all. Thanks, mate.
Troy Townsend from Kick It Out. From that to sort of less important things, i.e. football happening on the pitch. Marcus, it was the Marcus Beam Derby at the weekend, wasn't it? Brentford 7, Wickham 2. I did enjoy Wickham's Twitter account saying, goal to Brentford. De Silva puts the bees probably out of reach here. 7-2.
Yeah, probably. It was first half was very competitive. I think Ikpeazu, one of your former club. Cambridge's players was very good, a real handful. But I think second half, just through sheer, Brentford just relentlessness. Wickham crumbled. So it was a really entertaining game for obvious reasons, not just because of the goals, but some of the football being played and was excellent. But unfortunately, Wickham on the wrong side of a hiding, really.
Jonathan, the Copa Libertadores, a terrible game by all accounts.
Yeah, really bad game. Just nothing happened for a long, long time. A lot of fouls, a lot of diving, a lot of time wasting. And then finally, it all came to life 6 minutes into the 8 minutes of injury time when the Santos coach was sent off. But basically, the ball went out of play. He went to pick it up and the Palmeiras player, sort of trying to get the ball off him, shoved him over. And for some reason, Cuca, the Santos coach, was the man sent off. Didn't seem to... I think he was planning to waste time, but he hadn't actually had a chance to waste time. And then in amidst all this furore, he was ridiculous. He went off the pitch, but he was sort of standing about 4 yards from where he'd been before. He was still organising the team. And then Palmeiras went straight down the other end and scored with a beautiful cross from the right and then a gorgeous looping header.
Was the Santos manager the one wearing the quite extraordinary T-shirt with...
Yeah, it's a T-shirt with like religious...
the Virgin like Mary Madonna and child, the baby Jesus.
Yeah.
Huge. It was remarkable.
But in kind of like pastel colours. Yeah, he's noted for dressing quite informally. I think it was a very hot day, to be fair. I think it was like, 30-odd degrees, which maybe, particularly because the game was played to suit a European audience. Yeah, so it was on sort of early evening. I suppose it was 8 o'clock UK time. So I don't know what time that is in Rio. Is that sort of 4 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that? And I think that maybe meant it was, it was too hot to play properly. But yeah, it was a horrible game of football.
Well done to Jiz Hornkamp. I don't know why so many of the listeners to the pod messaged me to let me know that he'd scored 4 goals for Den Bosch. Producer Joel says, you do know why. Yes, okay, maybe I do.
Can you imagine if James Horncastle had been at school in Hull when Jiz Hornkamp had scored 4 goals? Like, just the horror of the, on the Monday morning after Jiz Hornkamp's 4 goals, being James Horncastle going to school in Hull, like the abuse he'd have got.
Can you simultaneously be, basically at the sort of at the forefront of intellectual football discussion, which is what we are, let's face it, and at the same time find the name Jiz Hornkamp funny, Barry?
I don't understand what's funny about the name Jiz Hornkamp. People have been tweeting me about it as well, and I don't get it. Is it some sort of reference to tents or outdoor cooking?
Alistair says, I mentioned to my wife that Jonathan Wilson has no interest in music. And a couple of days later, she said that she now feels really sad for him. Can he reassure her that not only is he okay, but actually that we're all wrong on this matter?
Oh, if people want to have an interest in music, that's fine. I just don't have space for it. What I would ask is, does she have an interest in Hungarian football of 1930s? And if she doesn't, then I also feel sad for her.
Peter says, can we stop the pretense that anyone tunes into this podcast for the football, please? What has Barry been doing? Did he socially distance the bench lady? That's a terrible... That can't be used as a verb. I hadn't proofread that. I do apologise.
I spent my 2 weeks off largely going on very long walks. I reckon I've walked about 70 miles in the last 2 weeks. A lot of watching sports documentaries and box sets and staring out the window, wishing I was somewhere else. Ideally, that wasn't really cold and wet.
Simon says, what did you learn about yourself?
I learned that I'm better in my own company than I thought I would be.
Than you are in others. Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you, Marcus.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Now, Tuesday or Wednesday, we're releasing the next pod, which will be in association with Yosimar. Philippe Auclair, Tariq Panja join me as we interview Miguel Maduro, the former chairman of the FIFA Governance Committee, We find out what it's like behind the scenes there, even though it's, you know, the word governance may switch you off. It is a really interesting interview. It tells you a little bit more that you maybe didn't want to know about FIFA. Then on Thursday, me, Baz, and another panel will be back to look at the full fixture list in the Premier League and the fallout of what will presumably be another overhyped and unsensational deadline day. So we'll see you then.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.